He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 to take on the moral dilemmas of the day are Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Reverend Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist. Reverend Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. Great to see you both.
Thanks for having us back.
Glad to be here.
So things have calmed down in Baltimore, thank goodness. What's the takeaway of this? What's the lesson learned here?
Geez, there's a number of them.
And quickly, Emmett, if you would, please.
We see the collusion of racism, of lack of morality, and classism. And this is what has led to where we are now, right? So all six of the police officers were not white,
yeah,
right? And so
right.
That was a shocker for a number of people because people are fixated on only the racist piece.
Yep.
But there's a lack of morality and there's a classism, right? We assume that all black people are poor and all white people are wealthy. And that doesn't equate as well. So there's this number of things that are kind of all comprehensive and colliding,
yeah,
that creates a scenario that we find in Baltimore.
And the wonderful thing is, because I think many of us really felt this, that you can never penetrate that blue wall of silence. And here is this state, you know, attorney who has indicted all of them, which is just absolutely amazing. We wondered.
Grew up in Boston.
Absolutely. And is shaped by what she has experienced in terms of police brutality. But I do agree with you, Emmett, that you begin to see a more wider, you know, swath of black life, that not all of black America who's talking about black lives matter are people who come from the lower economic strata of life.
Well, I love it. I mean, people can be skeptical, and I hope that their skepticism is proved wrong. But I love the fact this is a 35-year-old African-American woman. Mother was like 16 or 17, single mom when she gave birth, police officer. So she grew up in a very tough situation with a teen mom. Her grandparents stepped up to the bridge, as grandparents often do. Father was a cop. Grandfather was a cop. And it takes a lot of gumption to stand up against the cops because her husband's a city councilor and people are complaining about that and all this. But, I mean, she lives there.
That's yeah. right.
So she's walking the walk here,
yeah,
and she's so young.
And she has accountability. I must tell you, I, as I was sharing with Emmett, I was a bit perturbed by the mayor of Baltimore, and I was particularly disturbed by her calling the kids, the protesters, thugs. Because
so
that
the president, by the way.
And
yes.
Yeah, well, okay.
Yes.
But yeah, that was problematic, but she knows the community in a way that Obama would not. I felt he was echoing what she was saying, because anybody on the street know that that becomes a coded word for the N-word. She knows better because she also claims that she's a resident, a lifelong resident,
yep,
of Baltimore. So it was very, very good when Moby said, I hear you, I'm with you, in a way that clearly I felt that the mayor distanced herself.
Well, go ahead, Emmett. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say real quickly that one of the things is that also that she has to rectify.
Which
some
she?
Of the, Mosby, state attorney.
State attorney. Yeah.
Mosby has to rectify some of the things that happened in Ferguson and Staten Island and Cleveland and some of the other areas, because there is an opportunity to indict the officers. Now, what the outcome of the court case will be is something totally different, but she does have the opportunity to indict them, and I think that's what kind of helped the folks of Baltimore kind of settled down, because they felt that at least somebody heard their cries,
yeah,
felt their concern, and wanted to take the initiative.
I'm so glad you raised that possibility, because Marjorie and I had a little discussion about this morning. I have no idea what evidence she based these indictments on, so I have no idea if these are going to stand or not. But we all know what happened in Florida with Trayvon Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And you say
mm-hmm.
to yourself, I said to Marjorie, I think on the air, but at least off the air, prior to her announcement, was it on Friday that the indictments, I think it was,
yeah,
that,
yes,
that if there is no indictment there, this city is going to be
burnt to the ground. This will be
so
LA.
So the question
again. Yeah.
is, was this an indictment of convenience where she says to herself, we at least have a fighting chance to convict one or two of these on lesser charges? Or was it one of the merits? I mean, interestingly, you who are looking at me askance, Marjorie, not too long ago when we were on the radio, there was a particular person who you determined to have committed crimes where a statute of limitations may have run, and you urged the Attorney General of Massachusetts to indict anyway, even if he lost the case. Who was that?
That was Cardinal Law.
Exactly.
And Tom Riley was the Attorney General. I think he could have built a case against Bernard Law. And having that, seen that reconstruction that the New York Times did on Saturday of the whole trip that the van took and how they placed him in, I mean, this young man is standing up and healthy when he gets into the van, or reasonably healthy as far as we know, and he's unresponsive. And they talk about the repeated times where he said, like, he can't breathe, and the fact that he was unresponsive and they did nothing. So I think she does have,
maybe not for murder
in the first degree, but certainly manslaughter, or maybe even murder in the second degree.
And, you know, this is not an empty gesture or posturing. I think she cast a wide net. Em and I were talking about this because Emmett feels sort of like I do, that they may not be able to prosecute all six of these police officers, but they're going to at least get one. And it's also the hope that the one with the least amount of, you know, at least the lesser indictment will probably rat out the others.
Yes, and I also think it's a great symbol. I mean, even if there's a case and you don't wind up with everybody getting convicted, you say, okay, the system, to the extent it worked. I mean, we're going to get these people before a trial. Now, she did skip the grand jury, which I guess some people think is rather unusual. But we're going to get these people before a jury and let the system work, because that was what the sense you got all in these previous cases. The system didn't work like it was supposed to. You're supposed to indict people when there's probable cause. And for my money, there was probable cause in some of these other cases and no indictments.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, to your question, Jim, I think it's an indictment of convenience and compassion. I think the convenience piece is, yes, if there was no indictment, then the other part of Baltimore would have burned down. And I think that's the notion that we have to make sure that's clear, right? When the impoverished part of Baltimore was burning down, you know, there was kind of a gate around it to make sure it didn't spread, right? So we didn't have the Baltimore Orioles game because we didn't want the patrons and the fans to get hurt or whatnot. But when there would have been no indictment, the rest of the city, you would have had a sprawl. And then the compassion piece is, yes, she's a 35-year-old attorney. She's proven her track record. She has the great courage to
do
this.
She has chutzpah.
But there's also,
this notion that she's going to take down, you know, the blue mob, if you will. And that has to take a huge amount of
courage. But I think also politically it works for the American psyche, because it's sort of to mirror what you have said previously, Emmett, is that it gets away from this sort of very stringent dichotomy that this is a black-white issue. We're looking at this is a culture of policing in this country, and that it doesn't matter what color the police officer might be, this is the mindset and this needs to be corrected. But she said something very wonderful in her press
availability on Friday.
Right. She said that we have to really go after the bad cops because we don't protect the city when we allow bad cops to continue on and stuff. So I thought that in many ways—
And not all cops are bad. I mean, I think we have to make it.
By the way, I agree with all three. I just want to, and emotionally, I am totally there. And I read what you read Saturday, and I found it pretty compelling.
You're
or Sunday,
skeptical.
Whatever it was. No, I'm not skeptical. Well, I am skeptical. Not based upon, by the way,
on cloud nine.
No, not based so much upon the facts in this case, but based upon history, where there have been charges like this. And all I want to throw into the discussion is, while I think it was good politically and hopefully good legally, I wouldn't want to be somebody who was indicted, who was charged with a very serious crime when I hadn't broken the law, because a prosecutor, if that's the case, a prosecutor believed politically it was necessary to keep a lid on violence in a city. By the way, I have no idea if that's the case. I said to you, I just hope that was not the situation here.
I think it's clear when you read this, step one, step two, step three, that, I mean, laws are broken.
Did you think it was clear that George Zimmerman had broken some law? Some law, even if he hadn't murdered Trayvon Martin? I did.
I, to be honest with you, thought that was a little murkier of a case. I think he went after because he was a black kid in a hoodie, but I'm not sure.
I hope you're right.
But this looks like a textbook case.
It does to me.
She was very methodical and stuff. So
By the way, let me be clear. I hope you're right. And I read the New York Times thing that Marjorie did too. I think these, comparatively speaking, relatively strong, but we do know what political... I saw Elijah... Is it Elijah Cummings? What's Cummings first name?
Yes, Elijah.
I saw him on TV the night before on Thursday night, and I was stunned. He's standing on the streets of Baltimore, and he's being interviewed by somebody from CNN, and he is expressing over and over how we have total confidence in the state's attorney, Mosby, about 15 times. And immediately after it was over, I said to myself, well, obviously she's going to indict tomorrow. He spoke to her on the phone because he wouldn't have complete confidence in her if she wasn't going to, which is fine. I mean, political officials talk to each other in confidence off the off the record. But the bottom line is, all I am saying is, even if you were all right, is the charges are totally based on the facts, she had no choice, in my estimation, but to indict in these cases, even if the facts weren't there.
She could have waited. She could have waited. She could have waited. I mean, and I think the fact that she didn't give her some credit.
Give her a lot of credit.
Let's go back to the timing of the funeral. Remember, the funeral was on a Saturday morning, and everybody who backseat quarterbacked this thing, they said, you never have a funeral of that sort on a weekend. You always do it at the beginning of the week. She had to do something Friday morning because folks were getting ready to rumble
again
on Saturday.
Again. Absolutely.
I just want to say one thing, and I didn't bring it in, but I'll bring it in tomorrow so Jim can see it. Ross Duhar, that's right.
I don't know how you pronounce his name.
He's a columnist for the New York Times. He wrote a piece on Sunday talking about putting some blame on politicians for if you have a sense that some bad cops are running roughshod because politicians are so afraid of alienating the police. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing better than standing up there, you know, when you're announcing your the support of the Massachusetts State Police or the Boston Police, whatever it is, have all those blue uniforms behind you. And he was blaming politicians for being too soft on the cops because they're worried about not getting their political.
I guess one of the questions it raises for me is that could something like a Baltimore, I mean, it really happened here in Boston. Do we? You say no. Why?
Because I think we have a totally different message coming from the guy that's the police commissioner right now.
Oh, the one that we have now.
I couldn't agree with you more, Evans. Go ahead.
I think so, but let's realize that today at 12 o'clock this afternoon, there was a rally over in Dudley Square to mail a letter at 12:45 to the DOJ to ask for a DOJ investigation on Boston policing. And the rally was led by a number of activists as well as family members of individuals who have been killed, injured, or abused by police officers here in Boston over the years. And so there is a contingent of individuals who, although they're being forward-thinking and asking for reform, I don't think that the commissioner would disagree with that. And I think that's the difference.
I think there's rogue cops in Boston.
Absolutely.
There's rogue cops everywhere. But I think that what we saw with the riot gear and the militarization and the way the things were handled in Baltimore, maybe I'm being naive, but I don't think they'll be handled the same way.
Well, I think we have a better check and balance system. Well, I think we do. I mean, I think there's two Bostons, right? And you guys have had Jamal Crawford on here before, who talked about the notion that when the Marathon bombing happened and there was Boston Strong, it was really in regard to a certain side of town when you have murders and killings in Mattapan and Roxbury and Dorchester. And I think one of the great things that distinguishes Boston from Baltimore is the fact that we have the commissioner on BPR on a regular basis to be able to engage with the public. So he's accessible. So he's very accessible.
He's accessible in the way that these folks were invisible.
One last thing, you arrested them. Not just on Baltimore, but on America's cities. I don't know if I said this on the air to Marjorie today or if I said it before we went on the air. When I heard officials from Baltimore or community activists on television the last couple of days talking about how, you know, we were just recovering from the riots of 1968, what is that, 32, 45 years later. Yeah. There's a great line that, and I'm embarrassed to say, I don't know who said it, that Detroit was going to end up being Barack Obama's Katrina, which it has not become. America's cities are just, some American cities are a disaster and are ignored in ways that are just unbelievable. And when I know I'm going to sound really naive. When I heard about the rebuilding of this portion of Baltimore, where, by the way, it wasn't partisan. Everybody was saying this, that it's been 40-some years, and they still haven't rebuilt much of what was torn down. It's staggering to me. It's just whether it's the mayor, the succession of mayors, the succession of presidents, whatever it is, it is really a horrible commentary on all of us that we allow this.
A piece in the New York Times today talking about Baltimore being one of growing up in Baltimore, it's one of the toughest places in the entire country to escape the poverty that's there if you're growing up in that particular neighborhood of Baltimore.
Well, really they didn't, you know, that it's one because I certainly come from a place that is also equally it's difficult, and that's Brownsville, Brooklyn, New York, you know, and again, I think Obama said something quite wonderful in his public address. He says, you know, we really can fix this in terms of urban blight if we want to. And I just think that not enough politicians and other, you know, elected officials really want to do anything about it, because I think that we are a society that really sustains ourselves on a permanent underclass. And so this is that underclass.
Well, see, some people think that my calculation, and I've only said this 500 times in the air, so I'll say it 501, the vast majority of elected officials are making a conscious or subconscious calculation. Is my city going to explode? Mm-hmm. Is that bridge going to fall down? Mm-hmm. Is the water main beneath the street going to explode as well while I'm here? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is it's not, I don't get any political benefit from fixing it now. I should do things that are tangible. I should cut a ribbon on something that people can see, a new community center. And so this investment notion that is almost seen as anathema by the vast majority of elected officials is really the only credible solution to a lot of things, and the vast majority of policies aren't bought in.
And that's part of the problem, particularly when we look at the Commonwealth, you know, all of the action and activities around Boston, right? So when we're talking about the Olympics and the amount of money that's going to come into the city to build these new buildings and whatnot, you know, will any of that money go to help to rehab and revitalize Mattapan or Roxbury
or Dorchester
or the other side of Dorchester or Springfield, huge issue out there in Springfield?
Well, let's bring it home. What about Cambridge Area 4? And so the way in which they decide to address this issue is very simply what they're doing in a lot of these urban areas. It's called gentrification. Mm-hmm. So services that these folks couldn't possibly get when they were residents of this area. With gentrification, we bring in Starbucks, we bring in Whole Foods, we bring in a different demographic group that just because of the pricing of stuff, of real estate in that area now, just forces them out. So
So
it maintains the premise that, yes, you know, we are a country that certainly sustains itself on a permanent, you know, underclass. Mm-hmm. And it's an intractable way of poverty that is just impossible to get out. You know, we were talking about how these, you know, riots erupt. Well, these young men have nothing to lose in so many ways. Their lives are not going to be any different 10 or 12 years from...
Because they can't escape.
That's right.
There's no way to get out. And by the way, for people, including in my town, Brookline, where people are voting tomorrow on overrides, and there's a lot of hostility in some parts of Brookline about the METCO program. Every time somebody wants to raise more money, they go, let's get rid of those METCO kids. This young woman was a METCO student. Mosby woman, she was left Boston to go to Dover Sherborne, I believe, for her education.
We're talking to Reverend Emmett Price and Reverend Irene Monroe. One last thing you just made me think about. There's this mini debate that's going on. The first one over words was around thug. Mm-hmm. The second one is there's a commentator on CNN who refused to call these riots, the parts that I thought were riots, and referred to them as rebellions. Where'd you guys fall on that, Emmett Price? I mean, it seems to me a riot by any other name is still a riot. I mean, those who are destroying property, burning down buildings, burning down structures, they may have a cause, but what they were doing was rioting.
Yeah, I think there's an internal struggle because the media coverage is not all-encompassing.
Yeah, we're about to discuss that in a few minutes.
And so I think there is an approach to try to temper what we're calling things, since we're not showing the full totality of the expression of the civil disobedience. So the folks who are the rabble-rousers, how about that for a word, the rabble-rousers get more media time, the attention time, than those who are actively
sort
walking.
Sort of a continuous loop of showing criminality. But I have this
how
thing
about
here.
Hooligans?
That was the president's
I feel, I feel that blacks and whites riot for different reasons. I think that most time you'll see black people riot over injustice, but white people will riot over pumpkins and football. And we saw that. I mean, we saw that last year.
Future Money Theaters?
Yeah, yeah. There you go. Absolutely.
Okay, it's that time.
It is Pope Watch time. Now, there was a great story over the weekend about this gentleman that, I should say, it was a person who was called not once but twice by Pope Francis on the phone, and not once but twice hung up on the Pope. And I thought,
I thought it was Irene.
Irene Monroe.
Yeah. Well,
exactly.
Well, you're absolutely right, because if the Pope had called, or this person saying I'm the Pope, I would have said, yeah, right, and I'm the Virgin Mary. Had he called back again and said, yeah, I'm the Pope, and I say, well, then after I lay you out, you will need the Pope.
By the way, we should say the absolutely. Reason the Pope apparently every once in a while he calls somebody who has written a letter or who he reads about, so he was randomly calling this guy. But there's one Pope thing that I wanted to raise before you guys go. Is did you read – there's this Honduran cardinal who's sort of an assistant to the Pope who was talking about the Pope's visit in September. He's going to be addressing Congress. And his original plans, Irene Monroe, he wanted to enter the United States through Mexico. Why did he want to do that? Because he wanted to highlight the issues of immigration and justice and those sort of things. Now, he can't, apparently, because of logistical concerns and that sort of thing. That would get like a 5 on your scale, would it not?
It certainly would on, well...
A 4.2.
There you go. Yeah,
well, that's absolutely. Pretty strong.
That's strong.
I mean, it would have been really symbolic
absolutely.
And huge.
Absolutely. And it would be wonderful if he followed the trail that these folks had to take.
Well, I think that was the concept. Not literally,
so
but figuratively. I don't know how literally it was going to be, but that was the concept.
Oh, well, then I look at this man quite differently today.
Apparently you do.
All right.
I don't think he was going to walk all the way across the desert there. He is 78
but at least after see all. But at least see the terrain. At which these people had to walk in order to do this.
Maybe there's a Pope copter he could fly over it. What do you think?
Well, just the fact that he even thought that that's important to do.
I agree with that.
I am
really
so speechless.
No.
She's
leave
like,
it where it is. It's beautiful. You're a man of great reserve.
Keep Pope alive. How about that?
But I'm bummed.
We're hoping
Thank you.
He stays alive for a while because, you know, we're hoping that some of the stuff he's trying to do, he actually gets done anyway.
Good
Reverend
Irene
Monroe and Reverend Emmett Price join us every Monday for All Revved Up. Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated religion columnist, and the Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. Monroe and Emmett, Irene and Emmett, excuse me. Thank you for joining us. Okay, coming up, we're going to ask you about something we touched on with Irene and Emmett. What do you think about the media coverage of Baltimore? Has the media been wagging the dog when it comes to the rioting there? Does the presence of camera crews and network personalities create events that otherwise would not come to be? We're asking you about media coverage of Baltimore next on WGBH 89.7 Boston Public Radio.